Access number 27804, squadron leader Ian Blair, reel 32. Now, anything else about your time at Fold?
No, really, apart from the severe winter, we got on very well with the civilians, and they're nearly all civilians in the quarters, and I was taught archery there by the Americans. They were very keen. My next door neighbour was very keen archer. He came from Texas, small chap. He and his wife and his two sons. His son, they went off to fight in Vietnam, and he and his wife that lived next door. She was Mexican origin, and he was. Molina was his name. He was, he was American. I know he was a Texan, but I met him. I went to see him in the States subsequently in about 1988 or something. I hadn't seen him for years, but he stayed in this country for long, long years. Apparently, American civilians are required to return to America after a period of about 7 years in order to maintain their American citizenship. So I know he stayed in this country. When Fold finally closed down, the Americans evacuated. I had left by then, but they did. They evacuated and went down to Hythe and Kerwin, place, closed it down again. But I met him subsequently once in UK before. He went back to America permanently.
So what happened with you then? Well, when did you finish there?
Well,
January 67.
Yeah, post the phone. Oh, April 69.
What was your next posting?
My next posting was to RAF Lucca, that's Malta, which was great. I was in charge of the supply controlling accounting flight. By this time, of course, in the intervening period, 2 years, it had got well and truly computerized, you know, it was really up and running. So when I got to Lucca, it was established that there was a big, big organization there. Well, it was a 3-squadron station. And I just went about my business there. It seemed to be quite all right.
Any problems or issues?
No, only the problem. Initial problem was accommodation. In the first instance, you had to find your own accommodation, which I did when I first stayed in a hotel for 3 days, and then found a flat, and moved into this flat, which was just down the road, and eventually bought a car.
Did you bring your family out with you?
Yeah, they came out with me at the same time. It was flew out to Lucca. It was great. When I say I had.
So what do you remember about that time?
Two. Pardon?
What do you remember about that posting? Anything in particular? Or was it just the same as the last?
Well, no. It was a nice posting because there was always lots to see and do, but I got a job as offshore IC diving, scuba diving. Well, I say I took this job on actually because my son, who was in at home in university, was coming out on holiday and he wanted to do some diving. So I thought to myself, I better get acquainted with this system. So I joined the RAF diving club, and did my training, and so that when he finally came out on leave, a holiday, we could dive together, which is great. But then I subsequently inherited as officer IC the diving, being a senior officer, and I dived there as officer for 2 years or more, and it was really great. It was fabulous. I did well over 100 dives in the open, in the open sea. But what the diving? Well, we had quite a number of interesting places to go around the island. Our main thing was we were always fetching up bits of aeroplanes and things of that nature, and finding unexploded ordnance, which the Navy kindly came along and disposed of. The Navy were very good to us because they had a decompression chamber in the naval yard at that time, and they were very keen that we as amateurs learnt the good bits and the bad bits about diving and how to cope. And they did us some sample dives in the compression chamber, so it's just very interesting. But we were all roamed all over the sites on the island, and in Gozo as well, on the North Island. We found there was one Spitfire at the bottom of one of the bays on Gozo, the Northern Island, which was in about 50 feet of water. So we dived on that quite frequently, and we found its history and which squadron it belonged to and who was the pilot. We found that and tried to get the weapons out of it, but we didn't succeed. And eventually, the Maltese, the museums wanted us to lift it, bring it back to the Malta Museum. And we said, well, we haven't got the gear, and the Navy haven't got the whatnots, you know, the barges and things, because the Navy had just left. We said, well, it's not practical at this point in time. But it subsequently was retrieved, and it now sits in, or the remains of it, sits in the museum, Fort St. Elmo Museum. Is it Fort St. Elmo? Yeah, Elmo, Fort St. Elmo's Museum. But we had one VIP come out and dive with us. That was Joel Brown, the entertainer. He came out and dived with the club. He was a very keen diver. So, what else?
Had the computer system moved on at all?
Was it just getting better and better
all the time?
It just went from strength to strength. Yeah, it is a very good system. It's even today, I went to Germany to see my daughter, my son-in-law was posted there, and I asked him specifically to have a look around their supply organization. And this was must have been about 1980 something. About 1985 or thereabouts. And it's still the same problems, but the system has been streamlined so well. What happened, in fact, now is that the three services computers are joined together and all speak a common language. And of course, it's all part of rationalization, or was in these days. That was a big thing when I was at MOD, was rationalization, because you had, you know, had metric and imperial, and you were getting bits and pieces to marry up. So at Lucca,
Happened while you were out there? You seemed to have a good time diving.
Well, yeah, we had a good time there.
Not much happened with your duties. Steady as you go with your duties.
The duties were all right. What happened when we were at Lucca was we moved one squadron. There were two Canberra squadrons and a Shackleton squadron. We moved one squadron, Canberra squadron, back to UK with all their bits and pieces. And then we started to provide for the Nimrod aircraft. So for a long period of time, we had equipment coming in for the Nimrod, let's say some stores, and we were gradually getting more and more stores in for the Nimrods, because we had to rebuild the electronics centers and all sorts of things with all the sophisticated equipment. So we had a special. The last year was very, very busy, actually, in terms of stores to-ing and fro-ing. Oh, one problem we did have was, it was a typical problem, of course. The Russians moved into the Med about this time. Yeah, the submarine, Russian submarine, and it was part of the Shackleton's job to keep a beady eye on these things. And in order to do that, they had to constantly drop sonar buoys. Now, we were tasked with a limited number for, inverted commas, training. And when I say a limited number, it was virtually nothing compared to the numbers that these guys were using for real. That's all they had, but they were dropping all these sonar buoys to suss out where these... And MOD were very reluctant, to say the least, or to send any more out. They kept on saying to me, and it was very difficult to conduct a telephone conversation, security-wise, between Lucca and UK without saying, well, you know, we're tracking this. Anyway, the phone calls went from Lucca to... So it went from Lucca to Cyprus, to Cyprus to UK. That's how the route went. So, and it wasn't always good, but we had an awful struggle to do this. But we did eventually get an increase in numbers, but they had to be flown out to us. It was as bad as that. But it was all classified. Nobody would say anything about it. We even couldn't get access to the... ops room, they wouldn't let, leave me as a supplier, they wouldn't let me go in. So, I mean, I just have to go and talk to these guys. Occasionally, I managed to get sight of the odd photograph of these submarines on the surface, or a battleship or something, but it was all off limits. So we just treated it that, and we did our best. But that was quite interesting. But I just left then.
When did you finish there?
I left. I was cut my tour short, a bit short actually, because I left in 1971.
What month?
Hmm?
Do you know what month?
July. Pardon. Well, this next posting was to be my last tour posting, so I wanted to get my daughter into school and settled, and stay there for the final thing. So. I did. I managed to get posted to Cardington, 217 maintenance unit, Cardington, a gas factory. And the guy that I took over from was a former colleague of mine, actually. He was an explosives guy. It was an explosive post, just explosives and fuel post. So he and I are on the same explosives and fuel course. So we managed to take over Cardington. Now, Cardington was in the process of running down, I suppose. Yeah, I suppose it must have been. We were curtailing a lot of our stocks. The policy then was all compressed gases, i.e. nitrogen, oxygen, air, were all supplied by Cardington through... You know, the contractors, either they made the oxygen or the hydrogen, and they imported some from companies, liquid oxygen in particular, from British Oxygen Company. But we had this organisation set up there to put this oxygen into transportation cylinders, these long black 16,000 litre cylinders, which weigh a tonne. And we had a very good transportation system. We had a batch of Queen Marys, and they used to deploy these every week. They used to go do the circuits of all the flying units and drop off all these cylinders. That went on. They were doing 100,000 miles a year on that transportation system for 5 days of the week, going around dropping off. Then eventually it was decided that, well, aircraft systems changed, and... The inspection period of the transportation cylinders was increased from, it was 5 years to 10 years. And so that meant that the servicing line that we had for these cylinders, you know, it wasn't really up to scratch. It was quite an interesting job. We had they tested the cylinders. The actual factory had been going for wartime years. The gasometers were used for to store gas for the R-100 and R-101. And the two airship sheds there, one was used for airship manufacture, current airship manufacturer, and the other big one, the first one away, was used for the Home Office fire experiments. It was in a terrible state. It was so black and dishevelled because it's set fire to buildings and all sorts of things in there to study the effects. But the other one, the airship shed, was at one time was filled with one airship, but there was airship industries were building little airships there, and they were flying around there. While I was there, I managed to get a trip in one, and the only incident that happened was that was the Europa. You've probably seen it flying around with the Fujifilm adverts on the side. Well, the day before it was scheduled to be filmed for Blue Peter exercise. It was an American captain, Addiscombe, who was flying it. I've been on to him for a while, so he said, "Yeah, I'll take you up tomorrow." So tomorrow we went up. Tomorrow came and we were up, and we flew around Bedford, and I took some interesting pictures, you know, from my camera myself, and went back and landed. And the thing was put to bed, and it had along its on the side of it, they had a great big array of electric bulbs. There was 8,000 bulbs on the side, and they used to feed in these moving pictures thing through a system, and it was to display Blue Peter, etc., and all the other, you know. Anyway, they parked this thing on the end of the, well, they usually parked it at night, close to the hangar, on its portable mast. The portable mast was a big 20-foot thing on the end of a lorry, literally, and it was hanging on the end of this thing, and I was living in Murray Quarters there, and the bathroom window faced down towards Hitchin, and I was standing in the morning shaving before going to work, and I had the window open, and I could see this red, white, and blue thing sticking up above the buildings, and I thought to myself, that's funny. I'd seen that before. And had the radio on, and it said, the radio come up and said, road traffic. It said, the A600 is blocked by an airship at Cotton End. I think that was the name of the village, Cotton End. And of course, I could see this rudder sticking up above the trees. And I thought to myself, so I quickly got in the mini, I went down to Cotton End, and sure enough, this airship was draped across a great big tree in a house in the middle of the village. So nothing I could do about it. There were the fire Americans were there with the. Anyway, to cut the long story short, what happened was that the airship was on its mast, and the top 18 inches of the mast was welded, had a welded flange at the lower end. And the theory was that if the airship became detached from the mast, it automatically deflated. But unfortunately, it took the top 18 inches off the mast and didn't disconnect, so it didn't deflate. Because this flange had been spot welded, the spot welding had obviously fractured. And what happened, the airship just took off, and it drifted. It drifted downwind during the night, sometime 3 o'clock in the morning, and came to rest around this great big house and tree in this village. There were some cartoonist America or somebody drew a brilliant cartoon showing us little man on a bicycle sweating profusely chasing this airship down, which eventually came to rest. But the next day, for about 8 or 9 hours, the telephone from Cardington to US of A was engaged, and they flew out a new envelope, and they reconditioned the engines, and it was eventually rebuilt, but it cost them an awful lot. So Blue Peter didn't get their demo the following day, as it should have done. It's a pity. But that was quite an interesting exercise.
Anything else while you were at Cardington?
No, I don't. I don't really think.
Nothing new about the job then. You were just acting as.
No, I was just a supplier. Well, there was one incident. Yeah, there was one. We had our own little stock control office, and we used to ship our stuff via Henlow. And I remember it was Christmas. Christmas time. The workshops at Cardington used to service. The gas cylinders for the airfield arrestor barriers. Now the airfield arrestor barriers were gas operated, so that when you call for a barrier, the gas drove the mechanism and erected the nylon barrier across the runway to arrest any aircraft which were overshooting. They had a CO2 cylinder specially fitted into this thing. And I remember Christmas time, don't remember what it was, getting a signal in, say, the highest priority for stores in respect of air safety is air safe. Oh, but that seems logic. It's like an aircraft on the ground, but it's an urgent. It was the streamline. So we got this air-safe signal in, which from Akrotiri, saying they wanted a cylinder, they wanted the CO2 cylinders for the runway barrier, etc. So, which indicated to me that they were in dire need for some reason or other. I didn't argue about it. So anyway, the approval for this thing came from Harrogate. So I ring Harrogate up and I said, I've got these two cylinders, the air safe priority one for Akrotiri. So I went through to the job. The guy said, well, sorry, sir. He said, there's nobody here at the moment. They're all at their Christmas office party. I said, well, you go and get the guy out from the Christmas office and tell him I'm sitting here waiting for his approval to send something out to Cyprus as an urgent priority. Yes, sir. So I rang back in about an hour. I said, what's this? He said, you go and get him. I said, this is urgent. I said, you've probably got aircraft in the circuit there in trouble. So eventually this guy sent us up, but obviously somewhat the worse for wear. I said, look, I've got two cylinders for Simon. He said, oh, yeah. He said, that's fine. He said, oh, well, yeah, it's Christmas time. I said, yeah, I know it's Christmas time. I said, but the Air Force doesn't stop flying just because it's Christmas. I said, this airsafe means something to me if it don't mean anything to you. Oh, yeah, yeah. Anyway, so he gave me the approval and we sort of shipped them off down. But it just went to show the mentality of the civil service. It's not surprising. But that went out. The stores eventually arrived in Cyprus, obviously, because we didn't have any kickbacks. It wasn't any fault of ours, anyway, at the stores, because we put the thing in. Into service. We got the people in to do the work, and it was done. So what else? What else have I got? Finally, there was no actual mess at Cardington. It was a civilian organization. They had the biggest covered hangar in the country, or covered building in the country, which was used. Had been used for a fabric workshop in the days of airships, and it was now part of the RAF Museum storage for the historical equipment. Oh, yeah, archival equipment. And I went into it once and saw a series of uniforms hanging up, ready to be packed away, and one of them happened to be the Prince of Wales. Not the current Prince of Wales, former King Edward's. Is that right, King Edward? His uniform was hanging up, along with a couple of other high-ranking officers now passed on. Another thing, the guy was working on the bench. He said, stretched out on the bench was a whole series of components from an ancient Anzani engine, 25 horsepower, which he was rebuilding. Now, this Anzani engine was belonged to a Blériot monoplane, and it was had it all stretched out. It's a rotary engine, all stretched out on the bench. And he said, "Just look at this," he said. He was showing us how good the material was and how the quality of workmanship. He said, and I sort of looked down and picked up these ball races. There was two or three. He said, "Look," he said, "Volvo." And they're all stamped Volvo. He said, "I can go down to the local agent," he said. I said, "and I can get these from the off the shelf now, believe it or not," he said, "if we need them." But that was one quite fascinating. But that that unit, all the units closed down in the end. And the
before you left, or
no, there were some of them closed. They were in the process of closing it down. They had an MOT driving school there, but it was gradually closing down. The headquarters building was 1916 vintage. They were trying to retain that. They did for some time, but I always remember in the main hallway there, they had this monumental model of the R101, which was a great big thing with all its dimensions. The original gas pumps, which were used in pre-war 1920s for airship pumping the gas into the reservoirs and so forth, gasometers, were still in use, were still there. They were hoping to recover them back to museums pieces. But the gasometers themselves were unserviceable. Although they were physically there, they had rotted away, and there was more holes in them than there was. We had mobile plant there for producing oxygen and hydrogen, which was air transportable. And this was another thing that occasionally we got a panic requirement for a technician. Sometimes, technician nearly always, but sometimes a complete gear to be flown out to overseas units. Who was a chief technician, his name was Vickers Jones, was the expert on these plants. And so he always went out to the units abroad and did the technical recce, and if necessary, sent back for the complete replacements. It transpired that being the only RAF personnel there, his wife and my wife got pally, obviously being a para, because the rest of the thing was civilianized. And this Mrs. Vickers-Jones said, "Well, I must come down for tea one day." So I went round for tea one day at the weekend, and she was out came the photograph album, and she had her wedding photographs. And the guy on the wedding photograph, I said, "Oh, I know that guy." I said, "That's old Peter Thornycroft." He said, "Yeah." She said, "That's my brother." And he said, "Oh, Peter lives over at Brampton." Now, he was a sergeant pilot in 113 Squadron in 1938. I remember him. Anyway, I went and I had a word with him, actually. I never actually met him, but he was up working as this period of time, which was 1970 or 70, what? 71 or 2. He was working as a civilian engineer at Brampton.